exciting periods of our lives. We could talk about the flowering. No question, first of all, thanks to all of you. You've done a fantastic job, and Mars will never be the same for all of us. There's no question about that. The thing I guess I wanted to say is to explain some of the most obvious positive results, as well as some of the more confusing things. Are we still communicating okay?
Yeah, go ahead, Jack.
Okay, I'm just going to break in from time to time, because I know if it gets cut off, neither one of us will know. Certainly, there's no doubt at all that Mars turned out to be different than what we thought. Number one, the atmosphere. And I'm going to talk about three domains. I'm going to talk about the atmosphere of Mars. I'm going to talk about the surface features of Mars. And lastly, I'm going to try to untangle some of this very confusing biology that you must have been reading about on Mars. The atmosphere is by far the thing that has made the biggest dent in changes in people's minds. During the descent of the lander vehicle, what we did is get for the first time a real understanding of what the Mars atmosphere was made of, the actual chemistry of the Mars atmosphere. Now, people have conjectured that for a long time, but even the best spectrometers that we had could only make some kind of a dent in what we thought to be the major constituents. During Viking's descent, we discovered for the first time the existence of nitrogen on Mars. Now, nitrogen, of course, is important for biological reasons. That's sort of self-evident. But more important than that was an understanding of what the processes are that led to the current atmosphere of Mars. One of the things that we tried together was the things we saw from the orbit. From the orbit, it was quite clear that Mars has had vast flooded areas that have absolutely covered the globe, and something that was far in excess of what we had seen on the Mariner's data. And we couldn't understand where all that liquid water must have come that carved up the surface of Mars until we saw the nitrogen. Now, it was actually not just the nitrogen itself, but the isotopic ratio between nitrogen-14 and nitrogen-15. If you can imagine, and I know most of you aren't chemists, but if you can imagine nitrogen in two forms, one slightly heavier than the other, the lighter stuff kind of floats to the top, and the heavier stuff must be beneath it. As the nitrogen is actually lost from Mars, that is, the sun's energy literally brushes away or blows away, we call it a solar wind, blows away the top gases, it's the lighter stuff that's floated up to the top that's lost more than the heavier stuff. And it is the ratios between these two nitrogen isotopes, nitrogen-14 and nitrogen-15, that told us that the atmosphere of Mars in the past must have been far in excess of what it is today. Present-day Mars, if you remember I told you, is about 1% of the Earth. We found an atmosphere that must be some tens to hundreds of times larger than it was today. And that was really a rather astonishing discovery. Now, we also made measurements of the isotopes of argon, and it turns out the argon bears up the same relationship to the outgassing of Mars as the krypton Z, xenon, but the gases together, there's still some controversy over, because while they all point in the same direction, the amount of this outgassing differs depending upon which of these gases we use, and there's still a lot of scientific blood to be mopped up over who was right about argon, who was right about the nitrogen. If you remember, while I was in Australia, I talked about the Soviets having claimed that there might be 30% argon in the Mars atmosphere. They were dead wrong. We did make an argon measurement. The number turned out to be 1.5%, and I'm grateful for that because it allowed us to use the mass spectrometer that I mentioned to you in just the way we had hoped. Now, on the surface, it's the biggest dilemma of all. I know that Australian newspapers have covered us pretty well, and I know we've sent pictures to the station. The thing that is obvious is from the orbit, the places we landed at, the two sites, look vastly different. If you look at where Lander 1 went down, it's clear that we're in a very fluvial activity, a place that looks like enormous quantities of water have flown into it at one time or another, rather flat, rather featureless area, but distinctly having been formed by a water-dominated terrain. The area that we landed the Viking 2 in is clearly a volcanic kind of region, all pockmarked with volcanic features, the flow of ex-lava beds, And we fully expected to find enormous sand dunes covering some of that up. Well, if you look at the Viking lander pictures, it's clear they look similar. I mean, you don't have to be more than a high school kid to look at the two of them and realize that there is surprisingly similar scenes to be seen. They're both basically dominated by rocky stuff overlaying fine grain stuff. Now, how is it that these two areas that were formed so different and look so different from above were so similar when we actually got down and landed and looked at it? And that is still one of the big dilemmas on Viking. We still don't understand that. Now, the explanations go something like this. Probably since we have picked the blandest places on Mars, it may be that on the local area, that those kind of land areas are dominated by the forces that cause small rocks to be formed rather than anything larger or expanded. But still, there are many scientists who are trying to figure out the paradox of how the orbiter looks so different on the lander scene than from the orbiter scene. You might expect exactly the opposite. You might expect them to look the same above, but look quite different once we landed. But in fact, it just didn't work out that way. Now, lastly, before I start taking questions, let me tell you about the confusion about the biology and chemistry, because especially after all the interest I found among the stations in Australia, I know you wondered, well, did these guys find life or didn't they find it? They've been talking out of both sides of their mouth for these last few months. We haven't figured out what they're saying. The answer to that question is, to be honest, we aren't sure what we found. We found something quite different than what we expected. My expectation, and many of you had asked me that at the time, was that we were going to find a good deal of organic material, but we would have a hard time untangling the biology results. What we found were exactly the opposite. We found no organic material. Now, that's a rather surprising finding in itself. We used that fine GCMS, gas chromatograph mass spectrometer, to look at the level of down to parts per billion. That's D with a, like, boy, billion. And when you're looking at the parts per billion, it's like detecting the kind of, secretary wearing perfume down the end of the hall would be in the parts per billion range. So we really are at an extremely sensitive instrument, and still, we saw no organic material at all. We had expected at least that the organic material from carbonaceous chondrites would be there, or maybe some of this stuff formed the way they formed in a spark chamber would form there, or perhaps even the biological, but we found nothing. The biology, on the other hand, which we expected to kind of perk along every day, we'd explain to the reporters, sorry fellas, there's no change today, come back tomorrow, worked exactly the opposite. The biology worked just as though there were life. And I tell you, there were many of us during this mission that many times thought, we surely are looking at a growing culture. Many of us were willing to pull a cork in a champagne bottle at any time. As it turns out, the absence of the organic materials has us confused. We can't imagine how the biology results can be as positive as they appear and still have no organic. And it's that reason that you've heard us with this very equivocal, we don't know. We don't understand what we're seeing. Now, you've got to explain the biology results somehow, even if you're not willing to accept biology. And right now, the kind of current feeling is we're probably seeing some kind of very bizarre, exotic chemistry on Mars. Mars doesn't have much water, and so it is at least liquid water. It is a different kind of planet than we had anticipated, but we really didn't expect to find all the oxidation that we're seeing. We expected to see it being oxidized, but we didn't think it could oxidize something else. We knew that the red rusty color that we were going to see was probably due to iron oxide, but that gives us no problem. The problem is when we dump some of that in our broth, somehow it tears the broth up. And that kind of chemistry, well, you can account for it one of two ways. Either you say there's peroxides or oxidizes or ozonides or something, or you're stuck with having to believe that it's biology. And right now, we're unwilling to commit ourselves either way. There's one group of people who are off doing laboratory tests trying to understand whether it could still be biology, and another group trying to understand whether it's chemistry. Those, I guess, are the high points. Let me give you one or two others that come to mind. One major discovery you'll read about, if you haven't already, is that we've discovered that the permanent caps of Mars are actually made out of water ice, not carbon dioxide ice, as some people had imagined. And we discovered that during the summer of Mars, it's extremely bland as far as weather is concerned. You remember we have this little meteorology station on it. The weather has been There's been a wind, but it hasn't been very light, not even gusty, just a light, balmy breeze that is very regular during the day. It goes through a clockwise direction, starting in the east in the morning, and kind of moves around to a west during the evening. And that's very lovely because it's given us a very nice model to look at. But we didn't see any of those tense dust storms yet. Now, Viking, as you know, once we come out of conjunction, is going to enjoy a long life. I hope our burden on you fellas is a lot less than it is now. I guess you're going to get a burden from another project, but at least for us it should be much more mild. And we expect to follow the life of Viking for the best part of a Martian year, I hope. And that gives you sort of a kind of a bird's eye view of everything. Walt, would you like to have me take questions? How would you like to work?
Yeah, I think that would be nice. There's some additional people on there. There's some people out at Honeysuckle, and the people at Deacon, they're listening in, and the people here at SBB are listening in, so you can get the questions from any of those places. And of course, plus Tip and Biller was originally set up. Let me ask the first question, and it'll be open to anybody after that. Is there any good hypothesis as to what happened to the atmosphere of Mars? Where'd it go?
Oh, where it went? You mean the larger atmosphere that I alluded to before?
Yeah.
Okay. What we think happened was that when Mars was first formed, in the actual accumulation of the planet, that once it was solidified and then began to outgas, that is, the gases came out, that it was considerably warmer. And it built up an atmosphere, let's say a half of the total of Earth's atmosphere, or maybe even as much as the full of Earth's atmosphere. Then as the solar wind impinges on it, it literally causes a loss of material. We know we've lost material from the Earth's atmosphere. There was a different atmosphere here, and in the case of the Earth's atmosphere, some of the new atmosphere came from volcanic eruption. It came from outgassing of the interior, and Mars is doing the same thing. So most of the gases that have been lost are really sort of lost out in space somewhere, never to be recovered. Now, some of those gases actually get re-precipitated at the pole, for example, water vapor. Now we know what happens to water vapor on Mars. In fact, it's interesting. If you took all the water from the atmosphere of Mars and sort of made one big super ice cube, cube out of it, you'd end up with an ice cube that's about a mile on a side. If you compare that with what's at the pole, you really are impressed because the polar regions have 10,000 times that amount of ice locked in at the pole. So it's easy to account for the water that's left the atmosphere. It's probably solidified at the pole right now. And as that pole wanders around, it probably causes differing amounts of that water to be mobilized. Okay, fellas, anybody else?
Yeah, Tom, just let me ask you a question. Where do you expect to find organic compounds even in the absence of biological activity?
Well, I sure did. I must say, this organic thing has had me absolutely buffaloed. I can't imagine encountering a planet, a real planet out there with an atmosphere that has carbon, oxygen, nitrogen, hydrogen, has plenty of sunlight there, and that there isn't some organic manufacture. I guess there's two basic theories that account for it. Well, I'll give you both of them. And I'm not sure I believe either one of them, but let me try them. One is, maybe they never survived. That is to say, the ultraviolet light, and I'll give you kind of a far-out hypothesis. Let's suppose that the ultraviolet light forms some kind of peroxide material. For the lack of another name, I'll call it calcium peroxide. And that the moment that there's any water at all around, that calcium peroxide reacts with the water, forms hydrogen peroxide, and the hydrogen peroxide tears apart the organic material that's in the process of forming or that's coming in on a meteorite. Now that's a pretty unusual kind of surface, the surface that makes hydrogen peroxide. You know what hydrogen peroxide is. We've all used it for various times, disinfecting a cut or not. But to find that kind of a surface is something that we've never encountered. The other theory, maybe even more strange, and that is, let's assume there really is life still on Mars, and we simply haven't, it just doesn't fit our model too well. And the moment that there's any organic material, it's all gobbled up by the biology there, and that all we've done is landed a place where there isn't very much of this biology, the real biology is somewhere else on Mars. Maybe it's up near the polar regions or down south near the equator or down in the valleys or up on the edge of the volcano or somewhere else. And it just doesn't fit our model. And what we're seeing is a planet which is literally scrounged for organic, and that's the reason there is none there. Both of them, I admit, kind of far out ideas. Take another?
This is 44. Can we get in with one here?
Sure, absolutely.
Okay, just following on that last, I was wondering, we see a lot of pictures on various fanciful life forms prior to Viking, such as silicon life and things of that kind, or very seasonal life. So a two-part question, presumably the senses you have would not look for life forms other than those we know. So what about the possibility of some chemical life forms such as silicon life? And secondly, if, for instance, any life was seasonal, do you plan to keep some nutrients until after, into the extended mission period to look again then?
Great question. Good on both of them. Let me take them one piece at a time. As to the silicon life, of course, there's no way we can rule that out entirely. All one can say is, in the two places that we have landed, that is, as you know, those landers, all they can do is see for about a half a kilometer out. We don't see anybody out there. You know, there's no footsteps there. There's no nice big beautiful antenna standing out there. There isn't even a little cockroach around there. We really haven't seen anything yet. The possibility of microbial silicon life, but we simply don't have an experiment that would have tested for that. Not many of us ever thought there was a likelihood of silicon life. But it's the kind of thing that I guess if you got a half dozen scientists in the room, they'd start disagreeing with it. One of them would say, we still haven't ruled it out while it's not a very high probability. Now, the other part of your question dealt with, remind me again?
Possibility of keeping nutrients for later emission.
Right on. I'm really glad you asked that, because that is part of the plan. We've actually kept part of the meeting. We've actually kept the biology experiments working in such a way that we expect to carry out what is called the long incubation. Many of you have seen lichens. I think maybe in Australia you call them lichens. Is that right? Am I right? You know the kind of green things you see growing on a rock? It looks like a mossy thing, but it's really called a lichen, L-I-C-H-E-N-S. And I saw a lot of them while I was in Dallas Station. At any rate, those things grow very, very slowly. They really don't grow the rate of bacteria. And so, our plan now is just on the off chance that something is extremely slow growing to carry out what is called the long incubation period. It's an incubation period that might last, instead of 6 or 7 days, 3 or 4 months. We actually set up the suit and inject the sample, and we let that thing sit in there and percolate along, reach out maybe once every 2 weeks or so, and really watch for the long haul. You know, it may be that Martian just didn't never did mature to the point where they divide as fast as we terrestrial beings. And so that experiment is really one we give a lot of consideration.
We weren't thinking so much about long cycle, but seasonal in terms of Mars season. Something that came up from the depths maybe at a different time of year or something of that kind.
Well, of course, that'll get captured along with it because we won't take the sample until the next half of Mars season. We'll take the sample next time in January, February.
Fine.
We will naturally go through that part of the year. So.
Jerry, I've got one. If you could sketch out a Viking 3, what would it do that 1 and 2 weren't able to do?
Oh, crystal clear. It's an obvious thing if you've been sitting here, and some of it may be obvious to you. You'd like to get up and walk that thing around. It is so frustrating to realize that we're looking at just a small distance of Mars, and you just have a tremendous yen to get up on your feet, walk over the horizon, see what it looks like. I would love to have another Viking on wheels. Set something under it, even if it doesn't move very far each day. Give me the time and I can accomplish wonders with it. I'd just love to see what there is to see. you know, here we are 4,000 kilometers apart, and I can't explain to you fellows alone myself why the two sites look so much alike. Is that the way it looks like everywhere on Mars, or do we have to land in these two kind of sites? And if I set off on a traverse, I'd see the most remarkable. One thing to keep your eyes on, we'll keep sending you pictures, is the polar region. They've turned out to be among the most interesting things we've seen on Mars. They're totally different than any of the rest of the things we've seen. Those ice caps are, they're very foreboding looking for one thing, but they've got this sort of Catherine wheel appearance. And I suspect that you're going to hear an awful lot more about the Martian polar caps before this mission's over.
Now, this is Neil McVicker speaking. I have a question in reference to weather. Is the weather largely different as observed between the two latitudes? And secondly, do we know anything of the weather at the polar site?
Yeah. In fact, the weather at the two sites, from a general point of view, it's sort of about the same. That is, its temperature varies about the same amount each time that each day. It goes through an oscillation that's from site to site quite similar. The direction of the wind is exactly the opposite than the direction of the wind in the other way. But that's not an unusual thing, considering the direction of wind. The degree of the wind is rather similar. I think we're going to see the changes in them dramatically as time goes on. Now, one thing that has become extremely interesting since you mentioned the polar region are the measurements that were made. If you remember, I had mentioned we were going to make pressure measurements to sort of see what the pressure was. The instrument that we sent is a really extraordinary instrument. That pressure sensor is, I guess it ought to be, it costs $3 million. But it's the finest device that's ever been made for measuring pressure. When we began measuring the pressure in the first week, we realized there was every day a small drop, just as though there was a front or something. And every day we'd see this little drop, and as you plotted it bit by bit, crying out loud, we couldn't believe it, but it looked like the pressure was falling on Mars over a long period of time. And it's like over a week or 2 week period. And that was confusing for a while. And then one of the fellows on the orbiter, who was measuring the temperature at the pole, made another astonishing measurement. Now I'll tell you where the two fit together. What he did is he measured the pole of Mars, and the number turns out to be, and I'll give it to you in Kelvin. I noticed that you all realize it. Kelvin starts at zero, which is sort of minus 272 centigrade degrees. That's absolute zero. When everything is stopped, it's zero. Now, the temperature of carbon dioxide, solid, the kind of stuff we see in the bottom of an ice cream container, is 150 degrees Kelvin. This guy, with his orbiter infrared device, made a measurement, and the number turned out to be 125 degrees. Only 25 degrees below the temperature that you'd expect carbon dioxide to be. And he couldn't figure out how could he be measuring a temperature lower. Higher would be easy to understand, but how can you get a temperature that turns out to be lower than the temperature of carbon dioxide? There isn't any other gas that makes any sense. Finally, it dawned on us, what we're really seeing is the dynamic effects of the carbon dioxide as it's being frozen out at the pole. Remember I told you the drop in pressure that was taking place at the equator. We're literally seeing the long arm of meteorology reaching around and measuring the actual deposition of carbon dioxide as it began to precipitate out on the pole. And of course, as it began to precipitate out, there was literally a loss of CO2 in the total bulk atmosphere of Mars and a total pressure drop. Now that drop is about, almost now, it's over 5% of the total Mars atmosphere. Our anticipation is we'll probably slow up at about 10% of the Mars atmosphere. But you can imagine if we lost 10% of our atmosphere, what a dramatic effect it would be on here on Earth. Because it was an interesting way in which the two experiments that we had no concept of how they fit together in the end, but they did fit together. I probably over-answered your question, but at least you got a good story on it.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's Don Gray.
Hi, Don.
Good morning, sir. Seismic activity is, are you surprised at the lack of it, and do you have any explanation for that?
Yeah, I am a little surprised. I expected that we'd have more seismic activity As you probably know, our seismometer on the first spacecraft never did get turned on, and that's kind of a sad thing. Of all the instruments not to work, it's the one instrument where you really needed both of them in order to tell you the position of any seismic event, but we're grateful at least to have the second one working. We had a bet up here as to what would happen first, an Earth seismic event or a Mars seismic event, and the guys who bet on the Earth won. We had a magnitude 4 earthquake here in California just this last weekend. We still haven't seen anything on Mars, which I guess says that it's quieter there than it is here, at least based on that little sampling. I guess when you say, are you surprised, I'm a little surprised. I had expected with the tectonics that looked imminent there that we'd see something. Now, you know, the statistics are the important thing. That is to say, it could be that next week we're going to see 2 or 3 big ones, and what appeared to be a quiet period wasn't quiet at all. It's just the way the statistics worked out. But so far, there's been really not much to say, and I guess you're right, it's a little disappointing. Has there been any seismic activity in Australia recently?
Not to my knowledge.
Well, that's good. At least that doesn't hurt the antennas.
That's true. Now, I wondered whether this leads you to any thoughts on plate tectonics on Mars as compared with the Earth.
Well, not yet. We're still waiting. You know, we really, for our seismic experiments, you have looked under a month. Really, you wouldn't expect that that's going to tell you anything statistically. Once we get another month or two under our belt, then we'll be able to say, well, statistically it looks so-and-so or it doesn't look so-and-so. But I think our sample is the important thing. Until we get a decent sample, it's pretty hard to say. You can't make a seismic event happen unless, as you do with those seismologists want us to do, they want us to crash the orbiter right beside the lander. You can imagine I'm not going to let that happen.
I think you've got other fish to fry.
Right.
Jerry, while you may not crash one, since you've got a movement compensating technique now on your video cameras, is there any possibility of dropping the orbit down to a couple hundred miles and getting some better idea of the features at a closer range?
Well, as they say in the joke, it's funny you should ask, because that's exactly the meeting I came from and why I was late to this telephone call. We're now talking about dropping it probably in two steps. The first step would be to 800 kilometers. That's the guess right now. You know, we've got that problem with the quarantine people. They won't let us come too close to a planet without a guarantee that it's not going to crash for 50 years. But at 800 kilometers, we still get all the benefits of higher resolution without having to, in any way, take any chance on that. And I think that's going to happen. In fact, it wouldn't surprise me if the orders didn't come through to do that sometime in December after we picked up the spacecraft again. And maybe that will be the only big thing we do in December. I'm really looking forward to seeing that planet closer up. To go 1,500 kilometers to 800, even 600, would be very exciting. Have any of you seen the pictures of Phobos? Have we sent you a copy of that yet?
Yeah, we did receive it.
And you notice the parallel lines across it? As though you scratched it with your fingers?
Right.
Isn't that interesting? I'll tell you what people have thought about. There are some of the guys here who are saying that, you know, that may be one of Viking's most important discoveries, because we've never seen anything like that on any planetoid at all. The thoughts are that they go along two lines. One, those may be caused by large blocks of rocks or something that are in the orbit of Phobos, and as it goes around, it literally gets scratched by bodies of rocks that collide with it along the edge. It would be very interesting to find there's an awful lot of more stuff floating around out there than we had anticipated. The other possibility is, in a sense, even more exciting, and that is that this thing may have come from another body. That is, those marks may have been there before there was a Phobos, and Phobos came from some other parent body, like a great big asteroid or something. And that what we're seeing is the ancient history of Phobos before it ever never got it captured by my mom. Either way, it's kind of an exciting one to look at.
It's John Saxon of 44 again. Walt Larkin was expounding a theory to me about Phobos the other day. I don't know if he wants to put it on record, about the break in the end of it, and whether it could be that Phobos and Deimos were once joined and spinning became dumbbell-shaped and broke apart.
I guess it's time for you to publish that, because I've heard that deal here too, and it isn't the first time it's been suggested. One has to really go through the mechanics of whether those things would have ended up in the right place. And I know there's at least one guy here who thinks that's not such a silly idea.
Well, I just say that thing which they call a crater on the end looks
right.
More like a tear to me than a crater.
Right. In fact, that's why I say it really looks... one of the guys at one of the science meetings got up and made that and postulated that. And you ought to publish first before he gets up. Let me tell you a little bit about how the mission was conducted here, because I know since you fellows worked mostly just as hard as we did, you wonder what do those scientists really do on a day-to-day basis. We always say, yeah, we work 7 days a week. Our day was...